previously on Getting the Mecha.
We've felt, or I personally have felt, very comfortable watching the past 5 episodes, and although they've been amazing, they're still very good episodes of anime nonetheless, but Suruga Monkey really tries to shake the boat and rock the boat a bit. And then when we get to the actual fighting animation itself, it's also a massive treat. I constantly felt on edge watching this, and I don't think I can really get back that feeling from the first time. I'm Jamal, and you're listening to Guess in the Mecha, your weekly anime and manga analysis podcast. From inspiring arcs to game-changing cinematography, I'm on a journey to try and make sense of it all, episode by episode. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to Guess in the Mecha, and in today's episode, we are finally returning back to Bakemonogatari as we have in previous episodes, and in this episode we are looking at the Nadako Snake arc of the series. By the way, for those who are new to the podcast, it kind of says it in the intro, but I'm Jamal. I like to try and think about anime, maybe a bit too much. whether it's good or not is up for interpretation, but I just really love to think about anime and just have a good time breaking down and trying to figure out what it's all about. So in today's episode, what we will be trying to figure out is the Nadako Snake arc of the Monogatari series. Last time we looked at the Suruga Monkey arc, which was a really enjoyable one, and we got into quite a few things regarding animation and such. And in today's episode, we're looking at a kind of similar arc. It is a pretty dark one, but one that I think marks quite the turning point in the series, which I really want to get down into and discuss today. But anyway, let's not waste too much time. Here is the episode for this week. That is episode 93 of Guess in the Mecha, a look at the Nadako Snake arc of the Monogatari series. Before we dive into the content, as always, it's good to alert you of spoilers, because there are spoilers in this episode, and I refuse to be blamed if you are spoiled on something that you really like or are getting into watching. And there are, as I said, spoilers in this episode. That is, those are spoilers for the series so far, I would say. I wouldn't recommend just jumping to the Nadako Snake arc, but also spoilers for specifically the Nadako Snake arc, which, from my understanding, is episodes 9 and 10 of the series. So the Nadako Snake arc, as I said, is a pretty dark arc. dark for different reasons. More so, the darkness kind of lies underneath the arc and the ideas within it, but also the direction as well. And in order to really understand that, we need to see what is at stake. And so let's briefly talk about what this arc is about. Essentially, this arc begins with Kaburu and Araragi on a trip to the abandoned shrine that we see, will see multiple times throughout the series. In order to carry out a job for Oshino Meme, being a character we've met again in previous arcs, he is basically like the top sort of exorcist or oddities expert around in the town. And so on their way to this shrine in order to carry out this job, they encounter Nadako, who is pretty much the main character of this arc, as the title implies, and she's fleeing down the stairs of the shrine quite hastily. Alongside that, Araragi describes the last time he met the middle schooler, and that ended up being 6 years ago. When this job or favor for Oshino is done, they also encounter a series of dead snakes at the shrine, which really bodes the question as to who got rid of these snakes, who put these snakes in such pain, and the big question here is it Nadako? We then move later into the arc where Nadako is found putting down yet more snakes at the shrine, so it basically confirms that it is her who is doing this, and Araragi stops her and invites her to his home alongside Suruga, and they have a discussion as to what this issue really is. In that discussion, they end up revealing, or she ends up revealing, that she has all these very disturbing snake marks on her body. And that also reveals the nature of the apparition, or so-called oddity, that is inside her. Later in a chat with Oshino, we find out the reason for this curse manifesting. At first, it's said to be that she was cursed as a result of rejecting a boy that her friend liked, and then the boy cursed her. But the thing is that this gets even worse, because Nadeko and her taking out the snakes, in fact, made this even worse, according to Oshino. So now the goal is to save Nadeko and free her from her partially self-inflicted curse by carrying out a ritual at this abandoned shrine. But as always, this isn't going to be an easy task. This arc is made up of two episodes, the first being storyboarded by Nobuhiro Sugiyama and the second by Aoki. Aoki is a name that you might actually be quite familiar with, even if you don't dabble too much into the whole directors or animators thing. He doesn't only just appear later into the series, but is very famous for his work on Fate Zero and also It Invaded, which came obviously much later down the line, but I think more people are likely to have watched Fate Zero before they come to Bakemonogatari and discover Aoki. So this was, even though for me, this was my point of discovery for this director, even though at the time I didn't really know that was Aoki and who they were, but it's cool to see their progress then in Bakemonogatari versus now in It Invaded, Fate Zero, etc. I know I say this about a lot of episodes, but these two episodes were probably two of my favorite episodes of the series. Maybe not the best or the favorites, but definitely two very interesting ones that I really quite like. The second in the arc is probably the most disturbing one in the series so far, and I know I also kind of alluded to that in the Suruga Monkey arc episode, but this one really stands out to me. And when I think of the so-called horror of oddities and also just what this series is about, I usually think back to the Nadeko snake arc and that moment in episode 2 when they're trying to perform this ritual and it's kind of going wrong and Nadeko is like kind of choking. It's a very surreal sort of episode, and it's one that really stuck with me for quite a while, even after watching Bakemonogatari quite a good time ago. But before I get too carried away with Oki's storyboarded episode, let's talk about the first episode storyboarded by Nobuhiro Sugiyama. I know it's a bit inconvenient that there isn't video yet, but when there is a video podcast, it'll be much more convenient because I can talk about very specific shots, which I'm trying to talk about. I'll still try to make it friendly for audio listeners, of course, but I can actually reference a specific moment and show it on screen. So that will be a thing in the not so distant future, like very soon. But anyway, back to Sugiyama's episode. So I think this episode is very good for priming us for the second episode. And a lot of things that I didn't appreciate from the first watch is something that I definitely appreciate now. I also think that this was a time where I didn't really appreciate direction and storyboarding so much, but moving forward into 2021 and also just in 2020 as well, I think these things became much more apparent to me as to how much they matter. And so seeing this episode now and looking and seeing how beautiful it is and how well crafted it is, it hit a nerve, because now I really have to talk about it in detail. Direction-wise, I'd say the first episode is very faithful to this series and what it's been so far. But what it does really well, and something that I also think the Suruga Monkey arc did really well, was that it is really good for creating contrast. So it's really good at creating a sense of contrast. Contrast on many layers, on the layer of lighting and color, but also in terms of the ideas as well, and in the music too. If you've watched this arc, which I highly recommend doing if you are listening to this, I did skip out a few scenes because that would be very tedious to talk about them in the bookstore talking, but this is where those parts come in. So, for example, we're in the bookstore and we're chatting with Hanakawa, as you usually do in a Monogatari series episode or Monogatari series arc. It happens quite regularly. And it's quite tense in there. Even if there isn't any direct encounter with Nariko, who ends up being in the bookstore, there's this very tense and almost, I don't want to say battle music, but it's very cold music. I believe they're like these drums banging as well while we're in the bookstore chatting with Hanakawa. And the settings and the music completely are, they don't match at all. But I suppose that's kind of the point. It takes what is a very non-threatening scene and makes it feel quite threatening and hostile. The same applies to the opening to this arc as well. This is a very famous, one of the most famous openings in anime, probably being read as circulation, the one that you get in every single meme about anime in existence. And I know that this is a very good song, but I also think that there is, I think by it being a meme, not many people look into it. It's a very happy song, yes, but I think that's quite ironic for the content in the arc. And Nariko being a person who's very troubled inside, and we have Renai Circulation on, that kind of creates, again, more of that contrast and irony. It really bleeds into this idea of appearance versus reality, which is going to be the main theme of this episode, and the main point I really want to argue in today's episode, that what we see is not always what is actually happening, or at least there's a contradiction between what is happening internally within someone and what is displayed on the outside on film or on camera, so to speak. Although the opening is in the first 1 or 2 minutes, it's very telling when it comes to the entire arc. And looking back at it, and I know I did say I'm not going to use hindsight, but I have to use a bit of hindsight on the basis that I'm rewatching this. And I think looking back at it, you can almost tell what this arc is about by watching the first 2 minutes, by watching the first bit of content, and then watching the opening. And it's diametrically opposed. It's two different stories. It's one where there's a very distant relationship between Koyomi and Nariko, and then when you come to the OP, there's this almost close relationship, an almost intimate relationship between the two. There's this familiarity between them. I would say that this kind of, we could kind of argue that this relates to the surrealist layers of the series. The opening we could make the case for as Nariko's subconscious and how it's representative of her thoughts and her view of the world and her view of Koyomi and such. But that isn't representative of what is taking place in reality, or at least within the main juice of the arc. Inside her head, there's this innocence that exists. There's this I can't do wrong sort of atmosphere that exists. But in reality, or when we transpose that to reality, she's actually inflicting harm and pain on her own being. Hence why she's taking out all these snakes, which is worsening her curse and actually what activated it. And that brings me to something that I really love about this series as a whole. It's the fact that every section of this show attempts to build character and build itself up, if that makes any sense. The opening doesn't just serve as an introduction. It is an introduction, and openings serve as a means of introducing certain credits which need to be shown in the episode. It's an important 1 minute 30 seconds on the level of production, but also it's also an opportunity to communicate a message. Essentially, Bakemonogatari is the entire package. The entire package tells a story, not just the bit which is assigned a quote-unquote story being the main juice or the main brunt of the show. But back to the contrast, let's talk more about the visual contrast which exists in this arc as well. There's a massive contrast that I just realized. It's something that we get throughout the show anyway, and again, it's something we also got in the Suruga Monkey arc as well, which you could argue also tries to illustrate the same point, but I want to make that clear in this episode. There's a big contrast in the lighting, for example. So in the dark of night, you have, obviously it's dark, and then you switch over to the light and the artificial light within the house. And I know it sounds obvious, but I think it also just does push that point a bit more, how we have these Darker Knight personalities of Nadeko and these Darker Knight situations. This, what is perceived to be a very cute and innocent girl, is also involved in oddities and harming herself, arguably, through these snakes. And so color as well also fits into this, color and lighting kind of mixed together, so I suppose they're part of the same idea. We have this massive contrast between the intense reds of the evening and the much more light celery green of the afternoon or the morning. And it's funny because these are things which we are very used to contrasting as well, red and green or red and orange when you think of traffic lights or even Christmas colors. They're very opposed, or they're always next to each other. What's also funny as well is how when we get to the oranges, that is when we spot Nadeko taking out the snakes, but then we see it in the green of the morning, and this is when she's fleeing away, when she's quote-unquote not associated with it. So this series, beyond just the character level, on the level of lighting and literal color, I think tells so many stories and lends itself to telling a greater story about who these characters are and what they're really up to. And this is where we meet up with this crucial concept of appearance versus reality, something which is embedded not only within this series as a story and within Isin's text, but also within the direction and cinematography, if I can call it that, of this entire series, from Bakke Monogatari to Kizu Monogatari to Owari to all of it. All of it contains this idea, and the two mesh together so well. What we don't see isn't always easy to grasp, appreciate, and understand, but it's important to note that that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist or it isn't present. It simply just isn't within our field of view or in our mental capacity to really understand. And that, in summary, is what oddities are within this series. They're an abstract thing, and because we can't see them potentially, or see them in a normal form, or one that's easy to understand and conceptualize, it doesn't mean that they don't exist. And that's the difficulty of them and dealing with these things. This really began to click for me towards the latter end of the second episode, when we discuss this boy who ended up cursing Nadeko, and the fact that we don't see who he is. We don't see his face for the entire thing. He's just a boy. He doesn't have a name. He's just a boy, pretty much. But it doesn't mean that he has no power or influence within the narrative, as he quite literally cursed Nadeko. Maybe not to the full strength, because as Oshino mentioned, that he was an amateur, and an amateur can't really bring much of a curse amongst or upon people, but he still has influence despite not being on camera or even having an actual name or within this arc. It isn't to say his act is unnoticed because he's off camera, and that's something that the Monogatari series can really play on. It isn't really based on who. I think we have to focus on, and something we kind of discuss for Kizu Monogatari, we can't only focus on who is present, but we also have to think about who is absent as well. Because, and those who are absent doesn't mean that they lack importance all the time. If anything, they can have some of the most importance without being there. And that's something this series tries to play on and manipulate quite a lot. In the case of Sengoku Nadeko, just because we can see and conceive an innocent schoolgirl, it doesn't mean that she is innocent or she has nothing or no part in the thing which she is doing. And that's why Bakke Monogatari is so focused on unraveling the layers and getting to the depth of what this is and the nature of the oddity and what is at stake. And we can only do that by not only being deceived by appearances, but getting to the core of reality. This is a bit of a side point, but I think the Monogatari series taps into something quite profound and something we can definitely apply to the real world, especially in like the internet age and web 2.0. And that's just the idea that not everyone is who they seem or claim to be. I more mean this in terms of we should seek to understand things more and understand people more rather than judge them on first glance. I don't really mean in the skeptical way as in you shouldn't trust everything. I do agree that skepticism is healthy to some extent, but I more mean it in terms of not everything is what it immediately appears to be. The situation doesn't make itself clear upon first glance. Just thinking about the internet and such, and me being on Twitter for about 2 years, I've observed this. Not like 2 years is very long, but I've kind of absorbed this and how people will make jokes about you and mock you or say something about you on the basis of the things you have in your profile name or what you have in your bio or your profile picture or something. It's like that is one layer of a person, and that layer is even just them on the internet. That's not even the layer in which they are in real life. And so it's like people are multi-layered people. And the Monogatari series points that out. And I think that's something we should definitely take on from this series, even if we're not directly applying it to our real lives. I think it's something, it hits on a note that is definitely applicable to the world right now. And so moving towards wrapping up, I want to make a bit of a final point and just more so reflecting on this arc. And I think that this arc marks a real turning point in the series. So did the sort of Gamonki arc that we spoke about prior, but I think this one really rubs in even more that removing oddities is difficult, and this is not easy. Like I said at the beginning, this arc I think was a pretty dark one, mostly because I didn't really expect it to be this. The previous arc did that for me too, when Araragi got absolutely owned and destroyed by Suruga in that fight, but this one, it's not as violent from the perspective of being fought, but it's still very violent emotionally and also visually as well. Again, when you see Nadako on the floor with the snake coming out of her mouth, that was really rough for me, honestly. And it just goes to show how rough exorcism and the removal of oddities really is. It's full of hard decisions and tough calls to make. And also it's just really difficult. It hit home for me when Araragi and Suruga had a moment towards, again, the end of the second episode, when they're at the shrine at night and she reminds him of what is at stake. It's either the curse going back to the boy, which is kind of how curses operate, or the curse staying with her. And it really reminded me that this isn't just a job or a task, but these are real people. I think Araragi also knows this too. These are real people with their lives and feelings on the line. This isn't just something to do just because we do it. There's a genuine purpose behind this, and people's lives moving forward are definitely going to be affected. And that's why we need to make actual rational decisions and think with our heads, but also our heart as well. Just a brief story to end on, not too big of a story and not that interesting, but I was watching Aki's episode for the first time at like about 1 a.m. in the night. This was about, I think this was 2 years ago, if I'm completely honest. It was either 2 years ago or like last year. It was in the middle of the night and it's like 1 a.m. I'm sitting at my desk and there's very minimal light. I'm basically in the dark with a tiny lamp on just to make sure like my eyes don't die in the night. And so I'm watching this and it's blaring in my face. I'm just watching that moment where Nadako's rolling on the floor and she's just struggling. And I don't think I've ever forgotten that moment since. I've watched a good amount of anime, but, and I've watched a few dark ones as well. I'm not like a mega horror person or something, but that really scarred me for a long time. Not because I'm scared per se, or I'm very upset by it or distressed, but it's just the idea, really, that someone is being hurt without, okay, it's a bit in their control, but at the same time, it's kind of gone out of their control as well, and someone that probably doesn't deserve such pain is being put in pain. And that's really what got to me, maybe because it was 1 a.m. and I was also tired as well, and the feelings were just elevated. But it's something that stuck with me ever since. That's basically what I'm trying to say. This was an introduction not only to Oki's work, but an introduction to a new side of this series that could be very uncomfortable. I wouldn't call it super distressing. It's definitely something you can get through. It's not a very long scene at all, and I think it's handled very well. But just because it deals with these potentially unseen entities and oddities, it doesn't mean that it's going to pull its punches on the visual level too. This arc is a small one, it's 2 episodes, but it's one that I can spend so long talking about because it's filled to the brim with value when it comes to its direction and also what it means for the entire series. It really, for me, defines what Bakemonogatari is all about in the space of 2 episodes, not only in terms of how it's structured, but how it's directed. And also how it manages to make us feel quite uncomfortable and question what really is reality. With that being said, that is the episode for this week. Not going to waste any time, let's dive right into closing thoughts, and I'll just briefly summarize what I've said and waffled on about in this episode. The Nadako Snake arc is a massive turning point in the series, but I'd also say that it's one that reminds me of what this series is all about. It deals with this fundamental contradiction between appearances and what we see on the outside versus what is on the inside, the true and arguably objective reality of things. We see this in its lighting, from the greens and the reds, and also the dark of the night and the artificial light in the house. Also within its music as well, Renai Circulation is kind of the, you could call it the antithesis of what this arc is, which is a very cold and hard-hitting one, and it's accompanied with a very soft and very positive and optimistic song. We also get so much more insight into how this series functions, as in it tells its story through the entire package, not just through its dialogue, not just through the main show itself, but even from the perspective of the opening. It is used to build this complete package that continues to tell its story of appearance and reality. These 2 episodes personally were a big shift for me. They changed how I thought about this series. It's one that can definitely be very uncomfortable when it needs to be, and also really remind us of its core messages and what is at stake, which are the lives and futures of real people. This task of removing oddities isn't simply just a task, but it's a means of changing people's lives, as they did with Nadako in this arc. Thank you for listening to this episode of Get to the Mecha. That has been episode 93. I hope you did enjoy this. I'm still getting kind of used to discussing Bakemonogatari. I think it's because I haven't done it in a while, and it's also, I would say it's a kind of difficult series to discuss. Not because I don't understand it or something like that, but it's more so that I think it takes a lot of thought. I think it's easy to take this series at face value and kind of just absorb it and not really have much to say on it, but I think it takes a lot of time to actually get to grips with what it's trying to say and what I think it's trying to say, and so I'm still getting used to that process, so do forgive me if I did get very waffly in this episode, but of course I'll try to edit it down so it's very concise and to the point. If you want to support the podcast, there are a few things you can do. As I say, as always, you can leave a like, subscribe, and leave a comment, particularly in the first hour. That really helps. If you go down YouTube, that would be very helpful. If you really want to support the podcast and you're listening on audio, what you can do is flick on over to YouTube and just like the video. And if you haven't subscribed as well, just subscribe there too. Especially if you do it at around like 6 p.m. British time as well, which is pretty much always when I get the podcast up on YouTube. So if you could do that, that would really help out. And I'm sure that would also help out like algorithmically as well, because that's how it really gets boosted. And then in terms of audio to support, the best way to do this beyond just listening, your listening is really appreciated. Follow on Spotify if you are on Spotify, so you can get it as soon as it comes out. But also on Apple as well, if you can leave a review wherever you do get, or wherever you can leave reviews, and that will help it algorithmically. And again, through the charts, that helps people see it, blah, 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 blah. Thank you for listening. Sorry I'm taking so long with this. I will see you next week. Have a great weekend. Mappa stages this weekend too, so good luck. And we'll see what happens with Chainsaw Man and the rest of the things. Loads of things coming. I have been your host, Shamar, today. Again, have a great rest of your week. And this has been Guests in the Mecca. The music in this production goes as follows. Chinatown by Alex McCulloch. Mandatory Overtime by Joth. Difference by Chasers Gaming. Synthwave by Alex McCulloch. And Anomaly by Eric Medeas under soundimage.org.